It's a couple minutes after 9 o'clock at 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, where for this next hour of programming, the opinions and views expressed are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. Good morning, it's time now for Talking Animals on KUCI.
The wildest time of day is on the surface of a kiss. It's time to break down all the frame. The lion is time. He is the same old sad refrain, but they can't hold him with no shame. Well, there's a chance to mount the flame. The lion again. Yet it's time to get free. You know that something bothered me. Well, I'm not too blind to see. The lion again. Oh, brother, let it go. Trying to get eyes to know. On the used to hear it roar. The line of game this time. That couldn't take away his song. He knows that he must stand alone. He'll need to have a heart of stone. The lion again. The lion this time again. He's in the circus and a cage. No wonder that he's in a race. The lion again.
Come.
That's brand new music from Van Morrison with a song called The Lion This Time as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Streaming live on the internet as always at KUCI.org. And the whole enterprise is broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. Home, let's not forget, especially within the confines of an animal show, of the Anteaters. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'll be with you till 10 o'clock this morning with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. Right off the bat, I'd like to tell you that for the next hour, you can reach us directly by phone at 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. And as we urge you to use that number, call us at any point in the show. Don't be shy, I'm telling you. We love to get calls. We're like the, Maytag repairman here, so we give us a call. You can also instant message us if that's your preferred way for listening online. You're not really the calling the radio show type. You get AOL Instant Messenger at your service. Screen name is, perhaps not surprisingly, Talking Animals. Other great, if less immediate, ways to be in touch include emailing us at talkinganimals@AOL.com. Or by way of our cool website, talkinganimals.net. Again, that's .net, folks. Also, before I move on, I want to thank Serena Sharp for another spicy, snappy, saucy session of the Serena Sharp Show. She was talking about alliteration earlier, so that's as many S's as I can hold together, I think, and not completely flub it. Meanwhile, here at Talking Animals, primarily we strive to learn about animals and animal issues from our guests, from news items, from your calls, from assorted other sources. But we're also here each week to celebrate animals through music, comedy, and other means. We aim for a spirited balance of those elements, as you can readily glean by, well, A, tuning into the show, B, visiting our nifty website, again, talkinganimals.net, where, once again, thanks to webmaster extraordinaire John Taylor, every show we've ever broadcast, up through last Monday, folks, with Linda Hellington-Jones, is archived. So listen to those shows on demand, as the phrase these days seems to go. So whether it's checking out the website and the archives, or hopefully having joined us in the past, or, well, by virtue of my telling you right this second, the heart of the program is really the interview we conduct each week with some notable inhabitant of some province of the animal world. Today our guest is John Hoyt, a longtime major figure in the animal world. He was president of the Humane Society of the United States for more than a quarter of a century, from 1970 to 1996. The former minister, Mr. Hoyt, introduced a number of structural and philosophical changes, not to mention some pivotal personnel, to the Humane Society during his tenure, and along the way forever altered the landscape of the world of animal protection. A term, by the way, he at least initially felt strongly should be used in animal in lieu of animal rights. We'll get into actually some of those things as well, hopefully. So there'll be a lot to discuss and learn when John Hoyt joins us in a few minutes here on Talking Animals. Meanwhile, it's time for our weekly look at items of interest in animal news. And I want to remind you one more time of the phone number to join us on the show with your own comments and questions about animals, not only this week's animal news items, although that's certainly fair game, but also any other animal topic you care to discuss. Something you saw, read, heard, whatever. Last night, for example, on a segment of 60 Minutes, they did a really cool piece on a story that broke some months ago about the dogs who were trained, and effectively so, to detect bladder cancer. So maybe if you want to talk about that or anything else. Maybe there's an announcement of an event. If you have an animal-related organization that's it's got something coming up that we should be letting people know about. Just any general thoughts, other things in the animal world. It's all fair game. It's all be most welcome. You can call us again, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. Or again, if you prefer to go the IM route, AOL and semester screen name is Talking Animals. I put you right here to the Nerve Center, KUCI. The studio, the Talking Animals headquarters, etc. Alright, so turning now to interesting and or important developments recently in animal news. Typically these are local, regional, national, sometimes international animal stories of note that seem important to spotlight. and with any luck to get your comments on and discuss. We also try to include a few announcements of upcoming events or activities that you may want to pencil in on your calendar. So, I think some of you perhaps know what's coming next. That's right. Let's Talk Turkey, as it were. And the animal news segment, typically, and today probably no exception, you know, is at least laced with, you know, some discouraging, depressing, you know, just sometimes dark tales. But here's one that sort of flips that around on its side, so that's why we're starting with this. Came to us by way of AP through CNN.com Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Police say three lions rescued a 12-year-old kidnapped by men who wanted to force her into marriage, chasing off her abductors and guarding her until police and relatives tracked her down in a remote corner of Ethiopia. The men had held the girl for 7 days, repeatedly beating her, before the lions chased them away and guarded her for half a day before her family and police found her. Sergeant Wandamu Wadaho said Tuesday by telephone from the provincial capital of Dita Gene, some 560 kilometers west of the capital, Addis Ababa. Quote, they stood guard until we found her, and then they just left her like a gift and went back into the forest, Wandamu said, adding that he did not know whether the lions were male or female. The news of the June 9 rescue was slow to filter out from Kifa Zone in southwestern Ethiopia. Quote, if the lions had not come to her rescue, then it could have been much worse. Often these young girls are raped and severely beaten to force them to accept the marriage, he said. Everyone thinks it's some kind of miracle because normally the lions would attack people, one of them said. Stuart Williams, a wildlife expert with the Rural Development Ministry, said that it was likely that the young girl was saved because she was crying from the trauma of her attack. Quote, a young girl whimpering could be mistaken for the mewing sound from a lion cub, which in turn could explain why they, the lions, didn't eat her. Otherwise, they probably would have done. The girl, the youngest of four brothers and sisters, was shocked and terrified, quote-unquote, and had to be treated for the cuts from her beatings, Wanamu said. He said that the police had caught four of the men, but were still looking for three others. In Ethiopia, kidnapping has long been part of the marriage custom, a tradition of sorrow and violence whose origins are murky. Yay for the lions. And if it's not too glib, too slick of a segue, we're going right into local news on the sea lion front. Well, we bang ever so loudly on the CD player. All right, excellent. All right, this one came from the Daily Pilot, headlined, Volunteers Rescue Sea Lion Pup Injured by Nets. In the 15 years Orange County Sheriff's Deputy William Nelson has been patrolling the harbor in Newport Beach, he has only witnessed two successful sea lion rescues out of 100. The second one happened Friday. A kayaker spotted the seriously injured 40-pound pup and called the harbor patrol about 8:30 a.m. It was the same distressed animal that rescuers had tried to catch three times earlier last week, Nelson said. Quote, sea lions are smart animals. They follow the food, Nelson said. Sometimes they go after baited fishing lines that have hooks. They get the hook stuck in them, especially the pups, and then they end up twisting the fishing line into a noose around their neck. When the pups start to grow up and get bigger, they can end up slowly strangling themselves to death. It's an awful and painful way to go. That was the case in Friday's rescue. The young sea lion that rescuers named Cobra had indeed entangled its neck in a gill net, which had dug deep into its skin, exposing bloody pink flesh. Quote, catching sea lions in open water is tricky business because they dive into the water when humans approach, said Michelle Hunter, director of the Pacific Marine Mammal Center, a Laguna Beach-based rescue organization, and by the way, yes, many moons ago, I'm talking animals. Most sea lions are rescued when they are beached on land, Hunter said. Center volunteers said Dana and Lynn Friedman were able to rescue Cobra on Friday. Quote, I cannot tell you how critical it was that we were able to save this animal, said Dana Friedman, who was bitten on his arms during the rescue. We've been trying for at least 3 weeks, and the situation was dire. I'm happy that the story has a happy ending, and Cobra will be okay. Nelson said he has seen more sea lions this summer than ever before, which brings us then to another offshoot story. Just to quickly set the scene, there was a barge, and probably still is, that I think was either for bait purposes or some other purposes, that was set in the Newport Bay, and it suddenly became a drawing card and hangout spot for a bunch of sea lions in the bay near Balboa Island, basically. So there's been, locally in the Daily Pilot, some coverage of this. And finally, because these sea lions would hang there and then they would bark all day long, and the residents were getting upset, so they finally kind of added some things to the barge to make it so that the sea lions couldn't really hang there, which seemed to solve the problem, and, sea lions didn't really get hurt. They just couldn't hang at that particular place. So that part I have no issue with. But along the way, this is from Wednesday's Daily Pilot, different, residents and people expressed their opinions, and as they should in a newspaper. But this letter, I thought, deserves special attention, including I'm going to read it all the way through. This is from Wednesday's Daily Pilot. A little sort of caption headline thing. Sea lion problem may need drastic solution. Walking Balboa Island most every morning with my husband, we have witnessed loud barking from across the bay. Now we're getting concerned that it is coming to our side of the bay. Just within the last week, there was a very large sea lion lounging on the Opal Street public pier, and our grandchild was unable to fish because of its presence. Their loud barking can be distinctly heard from our home, which is three doors from the intersection of Topaz and Park Avenues on Balboa Island. We're talking of barking we hear from across the South Bay on the peninsula side, floating down our street during night and day. It's inconceivable to us that these homeowners haven't banded together to protest before this. (Parentheses) They must have large supplies of earmuffs to get through the night. (Parentheses) Residents, where have you been? Suggestions. And then there's three little bullet points. Fence the entire barge so sea lions are unable to rest there, which actually subsequently is what happened. Relocate the barge out where the other fishing barge is located. Okay, now the third one I'm just, to pay particular attention to. Do what they used to do way back when, then an ellipsis, shoot them. Here's where we embrace, it's not even dead air, because that's the most pregnant pause I think I could muster. I certainly hope sea lions in Newport Bay don't become an issue like the destruction they caused at Children's Beach in La Jolla and the area next to Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. Sea lions need life in the open ocean, not in a man-made environment. I don't know if anyone saw this letter, has any thoughts. There's so many things that are sort of mind-blowing about it. Of course, nothing that can compare really with do what they used to do way back when, shoot them. But of course, this letter writer, this woman lives on Balboa Island and is disturbed by marine life. That seems troubling. And as for her references to Children's Beach in La Jolla and the area next to Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, there are many people who make pilgrimages to those places to see and hang and, maybe hear the barking of the sea lion. I made pilgrims to both those places, for example, repeatedly. And then, sea lions need life in the open ocean, not in a man-made environment. Again, the sea lions choose where they go. Decades ago, they chose the Children's Beach in La Jolla. And I'm not sure if it's the same timetable chronology or not for the Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. And in more isolated cases, they choose where they go in the bay. They're animals. They're wild animals. So, anyways, to Barbara Baumgartner, I just would like to ask, when, exactly, if you can recall, did your last vestige of humanity and compassion vanish? I'd love to know that. All right. A few more moments here, hopefully, and a few more things, including an announcement of a local, semi-local. It's actually up in Westchester, but local enough because it's so important. Best Friends Animal Society is hosting yet another huge pet adoption event. So let me just read a little bit of this to you. Best Friends Animal Society has teamed with more than 60 Los Angeles area rescue groups and shelters to present California's largest pet adoption event, the LA Pet Adoption Festival. Hundreds of homeless dogs, cats, kittens, puppies, parrots, and rabbits from across the county will be up for adoption Sunday, July 10th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Manchester Park, located at 7000 Manchester Boulevard in Westchester, California. Again, it's Sunday, July 10th. Bringing this up now, not only to give you lots of notice, but also we won't be doing a show next Monday, July 4th, so this is as close as we can get. The animals up for adoption will represent an enormous variety of breeds, and each animal has its own, often extraordinary story. Some have been rescued from mistreatment or abandonment, others have never known a home other than a shelter, and all are in need of loving families to adopt them. Quote, this is a very powerful event. It not only impacts Los Angeles' pet population crisis and creates public awareness of the problem, but also saves the lives of innocent animals, one pet at a time, says Francis Batista, Best Friends head of Los Angeles programs. Last year's event at Manchester Park, he went on, drew more than 5,000 people and resulted in the adoption of more than 350 animals. We sincerely hope to find loving homes for even more homeless animals this year. And it's pretty fun there. There's admission is free, first of all. There's children's activities, there's a silent auction, pet psychics, celebrity guests, pet products, food, refreshments, whatever. So for more information about that, you can call 310-202-4336. That's 310-202-4336. Or simply go to the Best Friends website. It's bestfriends.org/LA. And quickly, before we run out of time, I want to just offer a quick animal quiz. We got a little late start and a little too much blabbing on my part, so I'm just going to quickly throw this out, and then we're going to have to probably move on quickly into the comedy corner and then welcome our guest, John Hoyt. But here's the animal quiz. It's a true-false question. If you're the first person to call in with the correct answer, you will have your choice of various prizes, including a DVD from Triumph Insult Comic Dog, talking animal stuff of one kind or another, including a t-shirt, a sweatshirt, or a mug, t-shirts from other animal organizations, cat collars, dog toys, or vice versa, and books and CDs and other stuff that I don't have any time to specifically mention. So, true or false, call in 949-824-5824-949-UCI-KUCI. True or false, a rat can go without water longer than a camel can. True or false? All right, so while you're mulling that, just want to remind you, if there are ever any news stories or announcements of events you'd like to bring to our attention, please feel free to email us those items at talkinganimals@aol.com. We'd also love to encourage you to email us with comments about the show, suggestions of future guests, ideas about animal songs, animal comedy bits, any other animal topic that's on your mind. That email, again, is talkinganimals@aol.com. And I'm pleased to remind you, perhaps redundantly, maybe not. Yeah, probably so. About the Talking Animals website. We hope you'll check out the site. It's talkinganimals.net. Again, it's .net. And when you get there, please sign up for the email list. We can keep you posted on upcoming guests and other announcements. You'll also find archives and synopses of every show we've done up through last Monday. Yay! Sort of photographs and articles, both that we've written and that the media types and other types have written about us. All kinds of links, other audio pieces, and more. So please stop by and take a look around the site. Again, it's talkinganimals.net. It's time now to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which, as always, of course, involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Bill Engvall with a piece called Dorkfish on today's Comedy Corner here on KUCI.
See, I think we just try to figure out too much about animals. We should just leave them alone. I'll give you a great example. In the California desert, they found bones of a prehistoric porpoise. And they're saying it's interesting because this porpoise's upper jaw sticks out a lot further than his lower jaw. So I figure he's got to look like. And they're already trying to figure out if this upper jaw was used for like mating or catching fish. I'm thinking, what if it's just a goofy looking fish? You know, like a dork fish. He's like, old as ain't the ocean. Woo! I better find me some water. Because can you imagine if you were fishing and you caught a dork fish? Because you know your friends would be like, hey man, what kind of fish is that? You'd be like, oh, nothing. Because you know that fish would stick his head out of that bucket. I'm a dork fish. He caught me on a corn dog. I was swimming underneath the ocean, and I said, what's a corn dog doing underneath the ocean? But you know me, boy. I love them damn corn dog, boy. Woo! I saw that bad boy. I bet it. Boom, I was in the boat. That's the last thing I know. It'd be pretty cool if they sold them in pet stores. Because you know they say pets always look like their owners? It's like you go over to your friend's house. Hey, Buford. What kind of fish is this? Dart fish? I'm just fixing to feed him. What do you feed a dart fish? Corn dog? Boy, they just gobble them up. But you got to take that stick out. They'll eat that stick.
All right. That was Bill Engvall in the Comedy Corner with a piece called Dork Fish, taken from the album of the same name. And Bill's, of course, part of the Blue Collar Juggernaut and also performing locally here at the Pacific Amphitheater in Costa Mesa during the fair. I don't have the exact date, but if you're a Bill Engvall fan, you can see him right here in Costa Mesa in our backyard. All right. Comedy Corner, of course, by the way, is one of the signature features of Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Stress, and you're indeed listening to Talking Animals on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. As many of you know, we also stream live on the internet at KUCI.org. Some of you, no doubt, are listening that very way, and some of you, perhaps a subset, arrive there through our small website, talkinganimals.net. Before we proceed, I'm obliged to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in Talking Animals are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. Earlier in the show, I mentioned that our guest today is John Hoyt, a longtime major figure in the animal world. He was president of the Humane Society of the United States for more than a quarter of a century, from 1970 to 1996. A former minister, Mr. Hoyt introduced a number of structural and philosophical changes, not to mention some pivotal personnel to the Humane Society, and along the way forever altered the landscape of the world of animal protection, a term, as I mentioned earlier, he felt strong should be used in lieu of animal rights, although that, I think, kind of shifted around. That's one of the many things we'll talk about. So there's much to discuss as we welcome John Hoyt to Talking Animals. Are you there, Mr. Hoyt?
Yes, I am, Duncan. Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Great. Well, thank you for making the time. It's great to have you on Talking Animals here with us. As I just mentioned in the introduction, you enjoyed a long, influential career guiding the Humane Society of the United States at a 26-plus year, I guess, tenure.
I was president until 1992 and continued on as CEO until 1997.
Okay, all right, so we'll clarify that, but I mean your entire tenure, I guess, has spanned 26 years, which would, I guess...
27, actually.
Okay, all right, well, so far I'm 0-2 on the details, but I'll sharpen this up here. But so anyway, sadly, even if we talk fast, especially if it's 27, we wouldn't have time to spend even a minute on each year. So let's just cover as much ground as we can in a different way. Let's just jump in, perhaps going back to before you began at the Humane Society. Maybe you could just take us back to that time prior to joining the Humane Society, where you were living and what you were doing at that point.
Well, I was a clergyman. I was a Presbyterian clergyman in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and had been prior to that a clergyman in Ferndale, Michigan, which is suburban Detroit. And during those years, I was beginning to be uneasy about continuing in the ministry and looking for another career. I hadn't really thought about the animal career, but it found me, because the chairman of the board of directors of the Humane Society of the United States was an attorney from New York, and he was looking for someone he thought could build the organization. And I had had pretty good success in the churches where I'd been in that regard, and so he got hold of my name, called me, and the rest is history, as they say.
And did it seem, I mean, you know, of course, in retrospect, probably makes perfect sense to you and certainly to others that a minister would be selected, especially if they had that kind of success building a church, but, recruited to lead an animal protection organization. But do you still have a pretty clear recollection of how that notion initially hit you and others? I mean, did it make sense? Did it seem kind of a puzzling choice to some initially? Or
it sounded very logical to me because of the ethical dimensions of both the ministry and animal protection. I feel that ethics are tremendously important in both arenas. And the fact that a minister has a lot of responsibility for fundraising, for interaction with people, for leadership of a staff... I had a staff of 30-some people in my church, And so I came to an organization that had less of a staff than I had had in the church.
Wow.
It was about 12 people, which we built into a staff of over 200 before I resigned.
Boy, that, yeah, huge, huge changes, some which we'll get into in a moment. But what was your... so I see that in a way it makes perfect sense, and did even then to you, and obviously to the gentleman who recruited you. But what was your personal or sort of family history with animals at that point, since you obviously weren't initially prior to being...
I had a lot of exposure to animals during my growing up years. I spent summers on my grandparents' farm in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was a great animal lover. She knew animals by their name. She had a number of sheep, and she could call each one by name, and they would respond. I rode horses and milked cows and had a very close relationship to as well as to farm animals.
And, in fact, that grandma that you referred to, if I'm not mistaken, was she not a vegetarian, which was would have been years, years, and years before?
She was a vegetarian who lived to be 106 years old.
Oh, my goodness. So I guess it worked out pretty well for her. Yeah.
That's right. She died in a rocking chair stroking a guinea pig.
Well, there you go. For an animal person, I'm not sure, especially one who's 106 at that point. I don't know that there's a better way to go.
That was a very appropriate way for her to go.
Yeah. So in that first year, or even those first years then that you were guiding the Humane Society, what would you say, looking back, were the biggest steps or the biggest decisions you made, or maybe more to the point, the biggest challenges you faced in those first few years?
Well, the biggest challenge was to try to create a national organization. The Humane Society at that time had 5 regional branches, but they were their own independent branches. They carried the name of the Humane Society, but they answered only to themselves and not to the national organization. Their staff was their staff, not ours.
Mm.
And so I persuaded our board of directors without a great deal of difficulty to support me in trying to persuade these regional branches to become regional offices of the National Society. And we succeeded in doing that, and that, I think, contributed significantly to our growth in those early years.
Just so that people were all kind of working more in concert then as a result?
That's right. Working in concert, and their staff became part of our staff, and they followed our programs and implemented our programs on a regional level.
Yeah. And then once you settled in and made that, you know, key structural change and done some of the things, sort of gotten the hang of running your organization, how likely, even still, this is probably fairly early on, I guess I'm asking about, were you to implement changes or create policy based on either internal research or recommendations from your staff or some of those people, those offices that you created, versus, say, outward examinations of say what was happening or not happening on the animal welfare landscape? I mean, what kind of steered you as you were steering the organization itself towards policy changes or new directions?
Well, we looked at the needs that were out there for animals, and one of the things that we did that had not been done to any great extent within the animal protection movement was to hire professional staff.
Mm-hmm.
I hired a veterinarian by the name of Dr. Michael Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Who brought veterinary professionalism to our staff, which we had never had before. And we were able to address a lot of issues dealing with farm animals, particularly, and animals in research, in a way that we had never been able to with knowledge and integrity, so that we were not viewed as just sentimental people, but as people with some credibility in how we were evaluating animal abuse and cruelty.
We
added a number of professional scientists over the years so that we became known as an organization that could be trusted responsibly for its information and documentation of issues.
Sure. Before we continue, I just want to remind our listeners, this is Talking Animals on KUCI. We're speaking with John Hoyt, who led in one capacity or another the Humane Society of the United States for more than a quarter century. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have a question for John, please feel free to join us at 949-824-5824. So, Mr. Hoyt, while the Humane Society was you know, going about its business, and you had hired more of these professional staff, you know, you surely had far too many responsibilities as the thing expanded and grew to be directly involved in all the areas, you know, that the organization was seeking to educate the public about or affect change. But still, I think there were some issues you did feel particularly passionate about and did kind of have more of a hands-on involvement in. What were some of those, and why did they, you know, why did they mean that much to you that you were able to sort of still keep your hand in?
Well, one of the ones that I was very interested in was the humane slaughter of animals we had formed a Council for Livestock Protection with some other organizations, the Massachusetts SPCA and the American SPCA in New York, and a couple others, to try and address the issue of kosher slaughter, where animals were being executed before they were stunned, so that they were alive when they were caused to be killed, and many times we saw that they were being injured in the process. So we were able to develop a two-rail system for their conveyance, at which time they could be conveyed to the point of slaughter without suffering the kind of injuries they had been suffering before.
And just out of curiosity, just because she's been on a guest in the past, did you work at all with or have any input, or maybe this is just a different enough period, from Dr. Temple Grandin, or was she...
Indeed, we hired her to be the one to develop this system for
us.
Okay,
yeah, it makes...
Very closely with Temple Grandin.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, she's, you know, such an amazing pioneer in that area, but...
Amazing pioneer, and she had great credibility with the agricultural community.
Yeah.
So it helped us to have an entree there that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Sure, sure. And what were some of the other issues? I know that was very, very important to you personally, and I think there were some others. I mean, you know, obviously they were all important, but in terms of having time to get more directly involved, were there others that you felt as strongly about or nearly as strongly about?
Well, there were some that I was being the spokesperson for, and one of those was greyhound racing. Another was the use of animals in rodeo. And mainly those were issues that were being debated on the national scene, and we entered that debate, and being the president, I became the spokesperson for the organization on those issues.
And, you know, just because, you know, we've got, as most places do at some point or another during the summer, we have a, you know, the big county fair coming up here shortly in Orange County, and I'm embarrassed to say there's still a rodeo element to that. So maybe, since that is one of the ones that at least then and probably still now, you know, concerned you, maybe you could speak to why rodeos are problematic from the standpoint of people who you know, are in the animal welfare, animal protection area.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the training of the personnel who become the cowboys that do the roping and the riding and the ring that you see in the rodeo. And many animals are injured severely in those training sessions that people never see because it's behind the scenes. But even in the rodeo itself, the roping of calves, steer busting, and some of those issues can be very cruel and very harmful to animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had some calves necropsied after they had been roped, and there was hemorrhaging internally on the in the calf that one would never see just from observing a rodeo.
And that's just because of the rough, sort of treatment that they're experiencing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And what about, I mean, on the plus side, we don't have greyhound racing locally here, but maybe you could speak to that, because I know, you know, where that is taking place, and even still now, that is a huge huge problem. And what goes on with the greyhounds, or what's part of the training, or the other issues that that are, again, you know, troubling to people?
Well, the training there is also a cruel thing, because not all the animals that you see in the greyhound racing are all the animals that have been trained to be in it, because they only take the very, very best, and in the training process, they put them in with pinned-up rabbits that can't get away, and the dogs actually fall on the animals and oftentimes tear them apart before they're called off. And that's part of the training of chasing the dummy animal on the track in greyhound racing.
To instill that kind of desire then once they're on the track itself, is that the idea?
And we also have some horrendous things going on, such as dog fighting and dog-hog fighting.
Yeah.
We're now putting hogs in with the dogs, and the dogs attack the pigs, and they keep them in there until it's obvious that the pig is nearly dead and taken out. And when two dogs fight each other, they sometimes fight to the death. And it's a horrendous experience, and it's really illegal, but it still goes on quite a bit.
Sure, sure. Well, let's I think we've had our fill probably of those topics for a sec, but you know, when you were running the organization, or during, you know, or even during the times that you stepped down, I mean, how frequent was the incidence of the public having sort of either a fuzzy or even downright incorrect understanding of what the Humane Society of the U.S. does?
Well, I think that we had to spend a lot of time clarifying what we did and who we were and why we were doing what we were doing. And part of what we tried to do was to educate consumers about their responsibility and role in having animals. So many people who have pets, for example, do not have them spayed or neutered, and thus we get an offspring of pets that is just impossible to keep for a long, long time, and there are not sufficient homes for all the pets, and a lot of them had to be euthanized.
Yeah.
And that was a terrible problem. And the method of euthanasia for many, many years was very inhumane. It has become much better over the past several years with the use of sodium phenobarbital, but it used to be a very inhumane experience for the animal.
Yeah. And I mean, at least during some of the time of your tenure, maybe even to a certain degree now, I mean, do you find that people tend to think that the Humane Society mainly, or maybe even strictly, are the people who operate animal shelters, just because locally a lot of times when you go to, you know, to pick out hopefully a pet to adopt, an animal to adopt, whatever, you know, it's the Humane Society. And is there still kind of that
Well, of course, people see the local Humane Society with hands-on with dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to think of the Humane Society as relative to dogs and cats almost exclusively, which isn't the case. We deal with all kinds of wildlife, marine mammals, animals in entertainment, all kinds of applications of animals in society today.
Sure. And speaking of that, I just want to remind others one more time. This is Talking Animals. Speaking with John Hoyt, President Emeritus of the Humane Society of the U.S. If you have a question, please, or for John, please call us 949-824-5824. That brings up a point, Mr. Hoyt, because, you know, it seemed like, you know, sort of early on, if I follow this correctly, and if I don't, then hopefully you will correct me, that the focus seemed to be sort of animal protection, and you weren't even necessarily that supportive of using or having people at the society use the term animal rights. And then it did seem like that sort of shifted, or at least your view or the society's view of that shifted. Is that a... Am I assessing that correctly, or?
Well, animal rights came along sometime after I became associated with the Humane Society of the United States, and it had its most notable beginning with an organization called PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Mm-hmm.
Many of your listeners will recognize, of course.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we've had Ingrid Newkirk on the show, and certainly talked about PETA for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, those organizations tended to be a bit more extreme in their positions than I wished for the Humane Society to be, and that was why we used the term Animal Protection Society rather than Animal Rights.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem dealing with the rights of animals. I think animals do have all kinds of rights, but I think the term Animal Rights as a term carries so much negativity with it in terms of tactics that we just did not embrace and do not embrace still.
So that's still really kind of an important distinction for the Humane Society.
I think it is for the Humane Society. I think that philosophically the Humane Society of the United States is becoming a bit more animal rights in its orientation, but not in its tactics, but more in philosophical terms, more animal rights, but not tactically speaking.
And I gather, and this may be a smaller number, I'm not really sure what the number would be, or at least the proportion, but I gather that over the years, some people who may have been employers or otherwise involved with PETA have wound up working for the Humane Society.
That's correct. We've hired many people formerly with PETA and other groups. Recently, the Humane Society merged with the Fund for Animals.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fund for Animals was the organization begun by Cleveland Amory.
Sure.
Several years ago and had a great reputation of its own, a bit more radical than the Humane Society, but we have now merged with that group, and their staff is a part of our staff.
Sure. Gotcha. And then some, and I don't know how that merger has affected this, but some point to the Humane Society of the U.S. as the, or at least one of the wealthiest animal rights organizations anywhere. I mean, and I, you know, in doing some research to prepare to speak to you this morning, it looked like, you know, during your tenure and subsequently, there were questions about the, you know, the money, the fundraising, and how that money was spent and allocated. Did you think that those were fair questions at the time, or even now, or appropriate examinations, or was there some stuff that was sort of not properly portrayed?
Well, I think that we were attacked for many reasons, and one of them had to do with the money issue.
Mm-hmm.
We have been successful in our fundraising efforts, but that money is going to relieve the suffering of animals. We do have a staff now of about 400 people, so there's a lot of money paid in terms of salaries to professional staff.
Sure.
But that's how we are able to deal with many of these issues in a professional way.
Right, right. So really there was kind of a lot of, maybe that people were raising those issues because they were upset for other reasons, and it was that sort of a way to...
It was a way they felt they could attack it.
Yeah.
They survived that and continued to grow and continue to prosper.
Absolutely. And then when you kind of started towards the end of your time, they started to consider winding down your career at the Humane Society, was it kind of a tough, agonizing decision, or did you feel like having spent, again, more than a quarter century there, you were ready, that it was time, or was a little bit of both, or...
Well, I thought it was time for a change. I had been successful in helping to develop an international division of the Humane Society, which has grown and which is prospering at the moment, as well as the Humane Society itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we had two or three other divisions, the Earth Voice and Environmental Division of the Humane Society and the Center for Respect of Life and Environment.
Right.
Which was our division that dealt with higher education and some of the ethical concerns that we wanted more in-depth about.
Mm-hmm.
And we began back in the early 70s a youth education division called the Center for... NAHI, National Association for Humane and Environmental Education, which is functioning today and works with schools and school teachers very closely on educating children about animal and environmental issues.
Sure. So those first few years, being there as long as you were and then stepping down, I mean, did you find that you kind of wanted to really remain, within reason, kind of steeped in what was going on and keep a hand?
Well, I wanted to remain close enough mm-hmm. to be involved and aware of what was going on, and happily the new president has made that possible for me, and I do continue to work with him on some issues and some
sure.
other staff.
Yeah.
But I was ready to step aside and let somebody else take over the reins because 25 years is the longest I think any executive has been in a position with the Humane Society in this country.
Sure.
And I had become 65, which was not a unnatural time to think about retiring.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now that it's, about nine plus years later, sounds like you really do pretty closely follow what's going on, and obviously it sounds like still are consulted on, or you do consult.
I do stay in touch
yeah.
very much with what's going on, and delighted with the way the society is moving forward.
And what do you miss most, though, about being the sort of more, guiding the thing day to day the way you did for all those years?
I think the interaction with my staff and the mm-hmm. people that I worked with, that was a great experience for me, and I had great respect for them, and I think that was a mutual respect, and so we had great times together.
Sure. And almost the necessary corollary is, what do you miss least?
What I miss least is all the travel I had to do.
Yeah.
I was traveling about 75% of the time when I was with the Humane Society.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And that took me away from my home and my family for many, many years and many days out of a year.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's nice to be able to kind of stay put and enjoy, except for some occasional recreational traveling, I'm guessing.
Well,
right?
I do a little travel for the society now, but it's mm-hmm. very limited and nothing comparable to what it used to be.
Sure. Well, Mr. Wright, we're just about nearing the end of our time here, but let me ask you, is anything you've seen or heard, not necessarily about the Humane Society at all, but that an animal organization has done recently that struck you as particularly inspired or inventive?
I think that there's becoming a greater awareness on the part of the public of the issues that we're concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
Cruelty isn't so much individual as it is institutional.
Yeah.
And we're trying to get people to be aware of how institutional cruelty takes place, particularly with farm animals and food animals. Food animals are killed by the billions in this country, and sometimes their rearing and killing is not very humane, and we're trying to get people to be very conscious of that as they buy their food products.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like you really feel like over some time there's been some real inroads made in that way.
I think there's been great inroads made, and some people have chosen to be vegetarians or vegans, which keeps them from buying and using any animal products. Most people aren't in that category, and therefore we ask them to be very conscientious about where they buy and what they buy.
And if they're thinking about making a change, they should just keep your grandmother in mind.
That's right.
All right, Mr. Hoyt. Well, thank you so much for your time and joining us today and talking to
me. With you, and I've enjoyed it very, very much.
I likewise. It was a real honor and a treat, and we learned a lot. And I hope you'll keep doing all the good work for animals, even if it's on a slightly reduced, but doesn't sound like greatly reduced basis. So that's
all right,
great.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right. Once again, John Hoyt, President Emeritus of the Humane Society of the U.S., and obviously saw a lot of things over his 25-plus years in that leadership position, still obviously involved day-to-day, and then, of course, actually implemented a lot of the changes during that time. So we want to thank him one more time for joining us on Talking Animals. And I am Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals on KUCI in Irvine, 88.9 FM, streaming live on the Internet at KUCI.org. It's time now, of course, to proceed to name that animal tune. Okay, it's pretty much like any version of Name That Tune you'd care to mention or have ever played. Except in this game, of course, the tunes are always animal-related. So I will play a snippet of this little tune, and there will be a prize. Did he say prize? Yeah, prize like the other prizes I mentioned earlier in the animal quiz. So if you are the first person to call in and correctly identify the song, you will indeed have your choice of those prizes that we mentioned earlier in the show. So, as soon as you recognize this animal tune, please phone us at 949-824-5824. 949-UCI, KUCI. Okay, let's get started. Let's name the animal tune and Talking Animals here on KUCI.
If you didn't care, what happened to me? And I didn't care for you.
Can you name this animal tune? It's from a band that's made huge headlines lately because they reunited after a long, acrimonious split. Be part of the GA shows this weekend. And obviously it's animal related. So I don't know what else we can, other than hand you the answer, which we're practically doing. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. We have just about reached the end of this week's edition of Talking Animals. I want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KUCI, UCI, or the University of California Board of Regents. I want to again thank our guest, John Hoyt, who was at the helm in one capacity or another of the Humane Society of the United States from 1970 to 1996. I also want to thank you all for listening and Got sidetracked here. Next Monday, by the way, of course, is the 4th of July. So we're going to take that day off, but we hope you'll join us July 11th, the following Monday, when we return with a new edition of Talking Animals and another Hoyt. It's John's daughter, Peggy Hoyt, who is author of All My Children Wear Fur Coats, a book about pet estate planning. And she's an attorney with a nationally recognized expertise in that field. So it should be really cool and interesting. By the way, other great public affairs shows on KUC and UCI include Just Today Alone, the Serena Sharp Show, which of course precedes Talking Animals. Then at 5 p.m. we offer Counterspin, followed at 5:30 by Planetary Radio with Matt Kaplan. And that's just Monday, folks. There's great public affairs programming and talk shows like this each weekday, 8 to 9 and 9 to 10 in the morning. Then again from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. I also host a music show, by the way, called The Dead Air Zone here on KUCI. It's Tuesdays, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. I hope you'll check that out. And again, I urge you to check out our website. It's talkinganimals.net. When you get there, please sign up for our email list so we can alert you to guest bookings and other events and announcements. I also encourage you to email me with comments, guest suggestions, ideas about show topics, songs, comedy bits, news stories, anything else you'd like to pass along. At talkinganimals@AOL.com. I really look forward to hearing from you. And please stay tuned, of course, for Jeff Scott and the Blues Disease, his great, great, great blues show here on KUCI. This has been Talking Animals on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And as always, we're going to close things out here with an animal-related tune. This is Honey Davis with a number called Poor Dog on KUCI. We'll catch you next week on Talking Animals.
and the humid race, 'cause it's a poor dog, baby. Ain't got but one dog. Place to go.